So Psalm 18, I'll introduce it to you now with some introductory ideas. The psalmist in this particular prayer is facing certain death. And he was in the past, as you'll see, and he cried out to Yahweh, who powerfully intervened, as he sees it, and saved him. That's the background to the psalm. His enemies were put to flight, so it could have been a military campaign, whatever, and with God's strength, he pursued them and cut them down. So it may have been the king fighting against the Moabites or whatever. And he sees God's action as a reward for his innocence. That's how he puts it. The psalm celebrates God's care for the Davidic dynasty. God's promises, and here's the king, at least idealized in the psalm, the king being saved, and that reminds him of the promise of God to the Davidic dynasty. Now, unusually, in fact uniquely, this psalm is found also in the book, second book of Samuel, chapter 22, word for word. Which is not a bad little reminder for you, us all, that in, for example, in Isaiah you'll have psalms. And you'll have psalms dotted throughout the Old Testament prophetic literature. And this one has been chosen to be included in the book of 150 psalms. Or the author of the second book of Samuel, chapter 22, has taken a psalm and put it in his writings. So which way it goes, I couldn't tell you. But it is found in two places, except for this first verse. This first opening line is not in 2 Samuel. And it's quite an amazing line. So let's begin the psalm. I love, in the psalms in blue, the rest is commentary, I love you, Yahweh, my strength. Normally the word for love is ahab. And ahab is used throughout the, for example, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your mind and all your soul, etc., and all your strength. You know that text. And you'll find regularly throughout the Bible the idea of we should love God. But ahab, which is love, means obey, really. It means carry out your obligations to. It means commit yourself to the covenant. It's about a, as love is, it's about a decision that we make. It's not about feelings. They may or may not be there. But you've committed yourself to something, so you do it. And that's exactly what love is. I have one commandment that you love one another. That is, commit yourself to each other, do good to people, want their spiritual good, even if you're feeling desperate. Now, this word, however, Raham, it's the only text in the whole of the Old Testament scriptures, the whole of the Hebrew Bible, which uses Raham for our love of God. Raham in Hebrew comes from the noun Rehem. You can hear the sound similar. Rehem means the womb. The womb. And so Raham is a word full of feeling, full of... It's used a number of times, I think three occasions in the Bible for God's love for us. In other words, God loves us the way a woman loves the child in her womb. You know, it's a very tender word with all the feelings that you mums and dads would know. But it's never used of us and God, except here, which makes this quite a fascinating line. The author is saying, I love you almost the way a woman loves the child in her womb, which is a bit daring when you think of the divinity, isn't it? It's no wonder it only occurs once, but it is here, and that's what he says. So it's a strong emotional word for affectionate longing and desire and communion with God. I love you, Yahweh. My strength. The text continues. Yahweh, And what a wonderful list of things that he associates with Yahweh. Yahweh, my rock, my fortress, my escape, my God, my rock in whom I take refuge, my shield, my horn of deliverance, the horn that you blew when to call the army, you know, and my bulwark. So I don't know that in any of the Psalms there's such a powerful list of statements about God's protective care. I praise you, I call upon you, Yahweh, and I am delivered from my enemies. I don't think that needs comment. I'll just read on. Now he remembers how God intervened in his life on earlier occasions. The waves of death overwhelmed me. The torrents of destruction struck me down. The cords of Sheol. Sheol is the underworld, the Hades of the Greek world. The cords of Sheol entangled me. The nets of death held me trapped. So he's certainly facing, let's say, certain death. In my peril, I called upon Yahweh. I cried out for help to my God. And from his temple, he heard my cry. My scream for help pierced through to his presence, and he heard me. And look at the description of this. You can all relate to this, I'm sure, in different... He's using the images now of earthquake, volcanic eruption, violent storms, all to describe his experience. Then the earth reeled and trembled. The mountains were shaken to their foundations. They shuddered at God's terrible anger. Smoke issued from his nostrils, a scorching fire from his mouth. The fiery rocks erupted. He tore open the heavens and came down, a black cloud under his feet. He rode on the back of a cherub. I hope you know what a cherub is. These little late medieval big-bottomed babies that float around. No, a cherub, you see them in the Iranian temples or generally in the East. A cherub had the wings of an eagle, the face of a human being, they varied a bit, the body of an ox and the feet of a lion, or the other way around. You know, they represented eagle was flight, face was, of course, reasonableness, rationality, intelligence, and the ox was a symbol of fecundity, and the lion, of course, the king of the jungle, of power. So all these natural elements of power were all wrapped in this mythological, not real, of course, creature that protected the temples. So you wouldn't dare go in if you weren't the right person or had the magic symbol or were a priest allowed to go into the sanctuary. And so this is in the book of Genesis when God cast Adam and Eve out of the garden. He placed a cherub, which you could never dare pass, with, of course, the lightning. So whenever the lightning comes, you're getting too close to paradise. So you have to back off. That's imagery. Well, here it is there. God came on the wings of the cherub. He made darkness his covering, wrapped in a canopy of thick black storm clouds. All imagery for God's powerful intervention in the world, eh? As they see it. One little line might interest you. In the book of Isaiah, I won't give you the verse at the moment, I think it's 58, but I'll have to check that. It's not 58, so I don't know where it is. 64, I think. It asks God to tear the heavens open and come down. It's a plea from the disciples of Isaiah for God to break through the canopy, the firmament and come down to this earth. And you probably recall in the New Testament, at the baptism of Jesus, it says he saw the heavens torn apart and the Spirit like a dove descending on Jesus. Don't take that as a visual thing, for heaven's sake. If you can't read Shakespeare, you can't read the Bible. I mean, that's how it goes. If you read the Bible, you go and read your Shakespeare first to get the feel of what it's about. So, in other words, when Jesus was baptized, according to the New Testament authors, that prayer was answered. And here it is again. God tore open the heavens and came down. But, of course, now he came down in the form of a dove. Peace, gentleness. I am gentle and humble in heart. Quite unlike this. The power is in love power in the New Testament, in spite of people who continue to quote the Bible to support their militaristic positions, which of course is pagan, but rampant. I was pleased to see the Anglican Archbishop in Canberra said something in today's paper about that, and I hope they all come out and say something. But as usual, the Anglicans are the brave arm of the Christian world in some aspects. Verse 12, lightning announced his presence with hailstones and flashes of fire. Yahweh thundered in the heavens and the voice of the High Most High resounded. Okay. He shot his arrows. And what are his arrows? Lightning, of course. He shot his arrows and scattered them, terrified by the crashing of the lightning. Then the bottom of the ocean was revealed, and the foundations of the world laid bare at your rebuke, Yahweh, at the fire issuing from your nostrils. If you're a fundamentalist, you'd have to believe that God had nostrils, but for heaven's sake, you know, surely you can pick up all that literature. And what's that echoing? Couple of texts here from about Sinai, where the same language was used. It's language to create something marvelous. When Exodus chapter 20, verse 18, when all the people witnessed the thunder and lightning, the sound of the trumpet and the mountain smoking, they were afraid and trembled and stood at a distance. And Deuteronomy again, referring to the same thing. You approached and stood at the foot of the mountain while the mountain was blazing up to the very heavens, shrouded in dark clouds. So recalling that fantastic, powerful language, that's God intervening in this case to save the psalmist who was threatened with death. And what did God do? You reached down from on high and seized me. You drew me out of the mighty waters. You rescued me from powerful enemies, from those who were too strong for me. They came against me on a disastrous day, but Yahweh sustained me. He gave me room to move. He rescued me because he took pleasure in me. He loved me, took pleasure in me. So God came, rescued this psalmist from this inevitable pain. On that, you took pleasure in me. You might like to just recall, or I do anyhow, and so I'm offering it to you. Isaiah chapter 62, 4, it's the disciples of the second Isaiah, so it's after the return from exile. He has this extraordinary image for God's taking pleasure in you. You, says God to the people, you shall no more be termed forsaken. Your land shall no more be termed desolate, but you shall be called, in Hebrew, Hephzibah. My delight is in her, is the English translation. And your land will be called Beulah, married. For Yahweh delights in you, and your land shall be married. And here's Psalm 22, which we'll do later today. Commit your cause to Yahweh. Let him deliver. Let him rescue the one in whom he delights. So having reminded us in this psalm of an earlier occasion where he was saved, now the psalm moves on to speak about the faithfulness of Yahweh to the king and the corresponding faithfulness of the king back to Yahweh. Yahweh rewarded me because I was just. He repaid me because my actions were pure, because I have kept the ways of Yahweh and have not repudiated my God. For those of you who happen to be new today, this is a most important comment I'm making, but I've made it hundreds of times in earlier days, but need to make it again. When we're reading the Psalms, they're inspired prayer. Now, if God's going to inspire someone, he has to inspire someone. He has to inspire real people. And real people have limited concepts, have limited awareness, of course, we all do, are not always locked in, but they may have assumptions that they're not questioning, and so on. So as you read the Psalms, you're going to read assumptions that are in the mind of the psalmist that Jesus didn't hold, and that a disciple of Jesus won't hold, hopefully. And here's one of them. Yahweh rewarded me because I was just. We wouldn't say that. Yahweh isn't loving me because I'm innocent. If, to the extent that I am innocent, it's because Yahweh loves me. And isn't that the whole thing, isn't that the complete turning that Christianity brought, that Jesus brought? You don't have to be pure to be embraced by Jesus. He embraces sinners. Paul said, it was big insight, it was while we were sinners that he loved us. That's the shock. But God isn't there only loving good people and not loving bad people and punishing and angry. You got the whole picture? No, God is actually love. There's nothing more to God than love. So God is loving everyone. His sun is coming down on the just and the unjust alike. His rain is coming down on the good and the bad equally. Where goodness and badness and justice and injustice play an absolutely incredible role is not in changing God or making God behave nicely to us because we're good. It makes its incredible role in our being open to the love that God is offering, because love doesn't push in. So if I'm unjust, well, God is loving me, but I'm not receiving it. I'm blind to it. I'm got the blinds down. I can't see the sun. I'm in here and I can't experience the rain. But the rain's still there. Do you see what I mean? We're not influencing God. We're opening ourselves to God or closing ourselves to God. And that's key, of course, because you're not loved unless it's received. But this idea that you have to be innocent before you can come, and some of that was reinforced in our childhood by our training. You know, You had to go to, some people thought you had to always, I've never taught this, but or never was taught it, so you have to go, some cultures you have to go to confession every time before you go to communion. It was never church teaching, but it was a practice in some cultures. But we also had this kind of feeling you had to be good to go to communion, whereas you have to mean it, it can't be a sacrilege. But going to communion is actually going to the only one who can make me good. So as long as the longing is genuine, and as long as we're hungry for grace and forgiveness and all of that, you see what I'm saying? You don't have to be pure for Jesus to hold you. In fact, the prodigal son was loved into goodness, and it'll have to be like that for me and for you as well. So I think I've said it. So we've got a different understanding here than the psalmist on this whole thing of God's love, thanks to that beautiful Jesus who said to the woman in adultery, I don't condemn you. But then he said, don't sin again. Of course, it's sin. He's not pretending it's not. But he's loving her so that she won't. Not only loving her if she doesn't. But some of the, inverted commas, so-called Christian world, and it's usually on the right, you know, in every other sphere, talks like this and gives Christianity a shocking impression on the hungry, thirsty, sinful, struggling world, whereas Christianity should be the most truthful, yes, but incredibly loving community, shouldn't it? Open to all, and as I see it, I don't think it is. I think most Christianity is pseudo, seriously pseudo.
And it was made up of a two-part, inclusive and exclusive.
Christian, inclusive and exclusive. And one of the loveliest things that we hold, everyone should, but we do, even in our name, Catholic. A Catholic can't be exclusive. Absolutely. Catholic, you know, means inclusive. It means universal. It means all-embracing. It means open to all. So we who have that word in our name should be constantly reminded that, okay, if I'm going to dare to call myself Catholic, it means I desire to be all-inclusive. So if I behave in any exclusive way, you have to say to me, that's not Catholic. And of course, all the Christian communities, of traditional communities, say the one holy Catholic and Apostolic Church. They're all committed to this. But I see our church as being absolutely committed to it. But is everyone in it committed to it? No. Am I committed to it? Well, you'd have to look at my life and see. I hope I am. But at least it's the dream, and it's the... Anyhow, I don't want to go on. So we'll come back to our psalm. My key point, I hope it's clear, is that as you read all the psalms, don't read them as though they're the last word. Please remember, the psalmist didn't know Jesus. So you can't expect the psalmist to be, like Paul is, absolutely engaged by this new vision that came through Jesus and a new understanding of God, consistent with the best of their traditions, but very new. New and old, but new. So don't expect it there, but don't read Jesus, then read a psalm, and then average them out and end up in a bizarre place that ignores the incarnation. Come back to my psalm. Yahweh rewarded me because I was just. No, Yahweh loves you, whether you're just or unjust. He repaid me because my actions were pure. We would say he loved me, and so I was purified, and my actions became purer. Do you get me? I mean, whose actions are pure? I have kept the ways of Yahweh. Even if you don't keep the ways of Yahweh, Yahweh will be more loving than your grandparents, more caring than the mother at home who's praying for you and will always have the door open for you. Surely, that's beautiful to be like that, but that's only a small image of what God is really like, according to Jesus. Not according to the moralistic controllers of our world, but according to Jesus, that's clearly so. Because I've kept present to me all God's judgments, and I have not set aside his statutes. Here we have there's a whole lot of words in the Bible, and in English, of course, and any of you in the legal profession will probably find a whole lot of words too that I don't know. Different words have different meanings, and I wouldn't be sure how it was used in Hebrew, but I can tell you that the word used in statute here comes from the Hebrew haka, and haka means to carve something. So it's got the idea, a statute is not just something I tell you to do, for example, but it's something carved into stone somewhere. So it's, you know what I mean? It's you can't rub it out. It's got an etching, like the Ten Commandments, carved on stone. It's got that strong word about it. And I think that's the feeling of the word, so presumably that's the nuance. I kept blameless before him. I guarded myself against all guilt. Yahweh recompensed me for being just, for keeping my actions pure in his sight. I don't want to undermine that passage, but have you understood me? I'm trying to help you see one needs a broader view of this. Otherwise, you could end up thinking, if I wasn't like that, God wouldn't have saved me or loved me. That would be dreadful.